Exercise number 12035, rule 2.
Freddie Temple, reel 2. So could we go back now, and this, of course, is before the tribunal,
yes,
isn't it, to when you went into the FAU,
yeah,
your sort of impression of the unit. This would have been the, which camp was it?
The second camp.
The second camp,
yes. So in the autumn of 39.
Yes,
yes,
so still very early stage,
yes,
wasn't it,
yes,
in the FAU?
Yes.
Yes, what did you know, what was your impression of being with Quakers, for instance?
Well, I think to start with, it was so new, all this camp life, and while I played a lot of sort of squash and tennis at Oxford, having to get up early and in the dark run up the hill for quite a time, and all the physical side of the FAU was fairly demanding, and also trying to learn the Red Cross and other things. So I don't know how far one got then into very deep discussion, I think, which was a good thing to do. One realized quite soon that they were as human as one was oneself, with all the same sort of failings, mistakes, and muddledness that there was. And of course, Paul Cadbury, I hadn't realized quite how much I joined them. There's a hierarchy amongst the friends because they'd always sort of thought of them as all so equal, but the visit up to the Queen, as it were, Dame Elizabeth Cadbury, for tea, was a very much a royal visit. And when one went to the wealthy Roundtrees, this was so too. And Paul's visit, I mean, Paul was an incredibly energetic and wonderful character, and when one knew how devoted he was to his spastic, wasn't it, or disabled daughter, and the way he cared for her later without any murmur was wonderful. But if he arrived on the scene, everyone sort of backed away, and Paul was very much in control, as was right at the beginning. And I remember going to tea with him, and Stephen and I sort of said, "Please get us on this. If we get to Finland, please get us on this. We want to go to Finland." And so he did there. So in the early stages of the camp, it was more sort of getting accustomed to that. When it was long delays getting to Finland, I was a bit surprised, I think, although I suppose for those days it wasn't, that how well we were looked after while waiting to go to Finland. I mean, I thought we might have been put into sort of into camps or some school or something like this when waiting in Newcastle, but we were in quite good sort of second-class hotels while waiting there. And I remember wondering quite where all this money was coming from, and wouldn't it be needed later for ambulances and other things. And the voyage over, we weren't in any way second class. Well, I don't know what the classes were, but anyhow, the accommodation across to Oslo was extremely comfortable. The food extremely good, and in one sense, it was like that part of it, like going on a holiday out of wartime England, and of course, Norway hadn't yet been invaded, and so I remember sitting up late, and as we entered Oslo, all lit, and the fjords and everything, And then, while waiting there, and then slowly moving across to Stockholm and all the way up there, we stayed in very comfortable hotels each night there, and finally crossed over. And when we got there, the Finnish war had ended, but we still had a job carting refugees and others who'd fled from the war zone back to their own homes, and so we did a sort of ambulance ferry service in Finland.
How difficult was that? You know, I'm thinking of the sort of climate of Finland.
Oh, it was icy cold, yes, and many of us had just driven cars before, suddenly having to be expert drivers on ice and snow with lorries, and what was very tedious was you could skid in a very narrow road cut between high banks of snow and turn right round in the skid, and we were usually driving in convoy, then have to drive back miles possibly or great way before you could find somewhere to yourself to turn again, and you and sort of to the jeers and smiles of others in the convoy who were driving forward. Oh, so Freddie skidded today. And David Rowlands and I shared a truck, and I remember the hardness of it was that the passenger was always icy cold and wanted everything shut and all the heat on. The driver, with I suppose nerves and anxiety about the ice and snow, was always dripping with sweat and wanting everything open. So it was difficult. The driving conditions, and you had to be very careful. Of course, all the business of not touching anything metal, because it stuck straight away, your hands stuck to it if you hadn't got the gloves on, and others.
How about the plight of the people you were evacuating? You know, what sort of state were they in?
Well, nothing like as bad as anything we see at the moment there. I mean, the war had ended, and they'd got a fair amount of managed, I think, to get out before the fighting reached their part, and they took quite a lot of their own possessions, so one took them back with them. I learned quite a bit of Finnish. In fact, I remember I had to do the farewell thank you speech at a dinner at one place before we left. Possibly too, for me anyhow, in a way, one wasn't overwhelmed by the anxiety and terribleness of it. One was glad to be something useful, but it was quite a lark, in a way, an adventure to be doing that.
How did you get on with the Finns? What sort of people?
They were nice, and of course, as with any I found that as with any foreign language, if you'd start to try and speak it, they're very friendly and very nice, and it is a very difficult language. I forget there are about 12 to 13 cases to every noun. There's a different case for when a train goes going into a station and through it and not stopping, and a different case for when the train is going into the station and stopping there. that sort of thing. And we all enjoyed tremendously the saunas going in there, and this was a very novel experience for most of us. And the poor elderly women dressed in sort of cotton things who by decree had to be very fairly ugly and not good looking, who spent the day in there lashing you with twigs to stimulate the circulation and having Bordeaux to drink copiously from some bottle. We never knew what in there. Then we were all expected, I don't think I did this very much, to go out and roll in the snow. And of course one's learned since that Finland has more men die of heart attack in the early 50s than any other country in the world. It's the tough survive and the others go under, I think. But I enjoyed that. And the communal relationship, they say it's why the Finns are the most egalitarian society, because any dinner or any meal, the host lights, or in those days, lit his sauna, and you all went into it. And when you're all naked and undressed, you all feel very equal.
Well, were there other relief groups there working, apart from the FAU? Did you meet anyone, any other group from Britain?
I don't remember any there, no, that had got there. I think mostly fairly preoccupied with this strange phony war and when it would go on. Then, of course, suddenly Norway was occupied, and we all had to get back. We were told to get back as quickly as we could, and we were the first group travelling back. And it was very charming and rather sweet to find the way young British officers didn't know quite how to treat us and how we would behave, because. They asked us sometimes not to travel on certain roads at certain moments. This was because of troop movements. And they didn't like to say, because the British army is being evacuated, in case we would feel, oh, well, we'll dish that. They would sort of say, it will be better for democracy. if you wouldn't move today. And we, of course, got down in time to get out with the last lot from Namsos, and they probably interviewed others who arrived later to find the whole bay deserted and then had to scurry back into Sweden.
Well, what was your impression of the sort of situation in Norway when you arrived? You know, one hears what a rout it was for the British. Did you have that...
Oh, yes, entirely, yes. I mean, just scrambled on as best possible, and masses of equipment left, British equipment left. We had, of course, to leave our ambulances. We took out bits to make them difficult to move for quite a time. And then, of course, we were all put in a hold, and with masses of ammunition about, with enormous notices up, no smoking anywhere. And then as soon as the convoy started to be bombed at sea, we veered this way and that, so you knew sort of when, and you heard the great plunge into the sea beside you, most of the young Tommies lit up their cigarettes. So we wondered if we would go up in that way first.
Did you have any idea... as to the morale of the troops that you were with, you know, what they sort of felt of this?
Now, I think they're, as always, a bit the Swiss soldier is very resigned, sort of, oh, this is happening, and just praying and hoping they'd get home, and as to what would happen next. I mean, and then, of course, they all realised it's ridiculous. On the quay, before we got off, we are lined up on the deck in the various ships on the quayside at Glasgow, and General Carpenter de Wyatt sort of spoke and said, now I want you to realise you have not been driven out, you have merely withdrawn to fight again. And so this incredible general, who sort of had only one eye and one arm and at least a VC once, if not twice. I mean, I remember when he came to speak at some bailiff dinner afterwards, the person writing and saying, it was terrifying to know I'd got to entertain him. He was the sort of general who'd have swum ashore with his batman in his teeth. And then one got home and had some leave. Yeah.
Did you gain satisfaction from that? You know, this would have been your first FAU experience of service, wouldn't it?
Yes.
You know, When you look back, you know, on the Finnish campaign, do you...
Glad to do it, I think. I don't know whether one was then... would have been thinking in a sense highfalutin theological terms. I mean, we all do much more now. The young sort of talk about I want to have satisfaction in that bit of life. Yes, and especially from Oxford then, when the pre-war Oxford had liked to think, when people sort of worried that. Let's pretend and be as if nothing matters anywhere at all. I mean, I remember the man who, young airman who died in 40, I forget what the book was called, writing, and how he'd been in a rowing blue in the war, and they were rowing very casually somewhere in Germany. And weren't bothering about winning, and then he just said, "But some wretched young Nazi made the mistake, stupid young Nazi made the mistake of spitting on us as we went under the bridge. We instantly won after that." And so, one was sad. I don't know whether it would have been sad, because one was sad in a way that Norway had been invaded there. One was glad that peace had come in Finland, although Finland then, of course, went over to the other side and joined the Russians when the Russians were with the Germans there.
So when you returned back to, you know, in Britain,
yes.
Is this the stage when you did your sort of survey of the unit with John Bailey?
Yes, I think soon after that, well, there were signs that the... I would have been sent to Gloucester first, because it was after that that I was as well released to become... Sorry, am I fuddling too much? Yes, sorry. Would have been sent down to Gloucester first, because it was after that the decisions were taken that two group leaders should be appointed. So there was the period down in Sherburn Street in Gloucester, in very mucky. A little I was glad in that way. It was much more what I expected the unit to be in, rather simple, primitive surroundings, and with one of the unit who could cook a bit doing the cooking. And we did what seemed to me, I remember, incredibly long hours as orderlies in the hospital. I used to come home with my feet absolutely aching. And in those early days in the war, having been born in India and loving fruit, my mother used to send me sort of tremendous box loads of oranges, which could still be got in England. And then, when was it? Dunkirk happened sort of early May, didn't it? And they came back, and I remember we had to deal with the Dunkirk casualties. And they were always interesting. They would ask who we were and what we were, and you would say why, and what are you getting paid, mate? And then that was the astonishment, of course, to find it was nothing there. And then, evidently, the unit started to feel that the spiritual side, I suppose, and the purpose of the unit... being allowed to express itself enough, and so each section, I think, sent representatives to London for a great meeting. I think Paul Cadbury didn't really understand this. It was and dealt with it a bit as he would have done if the work side of Cadbury's had been a bit discontented, and how do we keep them quiet? And John Bailey may have given a different impression to that. And then two of us were appointed. I expect you've managed to get hold of FAU Chronicles. I mean, the early FAU Chronicles have this sort of thing. And I remember I had to write... I wrote something about it in the form of the quarrels within a chocolate box. And some of the chocolates had soft centres and were ready to have anyone squash them. And some of them had hard and some of them this. And so then what was rather an easy job in a way, I suppose. Oh, it was very interesting. One went round to all the units and if they had troubles, tried to meet the person in the hospital or wherever they were. It was mostly hospital work there. And to help argue out a situation to talk with the unit and then go back to London and report how they were there.
What was there much rebellion, would you say, at that stage, you know?
There was unease and restiveness, I think, because they felt they'd all joined up with a great purpose of doing things, and one realises now, the poor people in charge, they hadn't managed to find... There wasn't enough to do, really, especially when we'd been driven out of France. And just the hospital work there, and wanted some sign that there would be other things, and so that's why later on the Syrian side and the China side opened up, I think.
Were there sort of grumbles about the democracy?
Who was running it and why were they appointed and did they know? All the businesses one knows since then about the centre never being in touch with what's happening at the grassroots there.
And did the centre listen, you know, when you fed this back?
Yes, they did quite a bit, I think. John and I were always given a fairly good hearing. I suppose I possibly was tended to be the wilder, the slightly more radical than what I suggested. John was always the wise counsellor, and of course from a Quaker point of view more there. So I had to be careful that people said, "Oh well, you don't understand Quakerism. We do things so gently and so quietly, and that sort of thing." Now, in charge of the unit in Gloucester, one soon realised just how frail and human Quakers were, like the rest of us. There's just as much one or two who wouldn't want to work as hard as they should, and one or two who would want to be off with the girls more, in this sort of way.
Did you find, though, the sort of Quaker way of working through problems difficult to cope with? You know, the fact that they seek this consensus, and there's no what one could say cut and thrust to their debates. What was that difficult for non-Quakers, do you think?
Yes, although one side of one approved of it quite a bit. I mean, and A.D. Lindsay at Balliol had been very, had always illustrated Quakerism as, in one sense, he said, the best form of democracy, because it's better than just having individual votes this way, if you can, really. But then the group has to be small. And my uncle used to say, sort of, democracy is not... he said, "I will never describe democracy as the best form of government. It's the least bad." and he said, all through history, majorities have usually been wrong in the end. that anything good starts from minorities. It depended always there, I think, on what the clerk of the meeting or the person in charge of the meeting, how he ran it and got towards this consensus. And I realised very soon what outsiders used to think, oh, Quaker worship must be marvellous, this silence. And It's either superb, in some cases, when people have prepared themselves well, as they're meant to, before it, and only offer something really worthwhile, or it's utterly banal. I mean, at Gloucester, it was quite appalling, because there's one dear elderly friend who always felt he must minister, and it was always about what the Spirit had said to him through the latest flowers that were in his garden. And we sort of smiled at each other, sort of thing. Thank heavens the primroses are over now. We'll be on to the roses soon. people tell me he ought to, the right phrase is, been eldered and told to shut up more. But he wasn't eldered, and we knew he would always minister, just possibly when your own thoughts were getting onto something fairly reasonable. And I think it was there one realized that if they'd come through a Quaker school, well, it had all been their sort of this way of life, and this way, that some of them could be very wishy-washy, charming, but and Michael Cadbury and the sort of broadcast he's done, Chocolate Soldiers and other things, it's always stressed there, well, what was the main thing? The Quaker time for worship and the Quaker way of life. But one never finds much more about sort of pacifism right to the end or something. That, and then how far does that go then if you're making a good deal of money through your chocolates. I have to give them credit that they're a tiny little religious denomination, yet nearly always when there's some crisis you'll find a little group of Quakers are there amongst the first doing something about it. And in the great days of documents and other things, sort of on this or that, it was very often the Quaker or the Friends document that came out quite early on, putting different points of view.
Would you say in your experience, you know, with the FAU right the way through the war, did the sort of democratic ethos, did it alter? Did the unit alter in this way, would you say?
People say, I don't know, so that this, it went on into the China. I mean, this may be just because it went further away, and you can always feel something farther away is better than something close. That, as I've heard people say, that the China section kept more of the spiritual side of things than the others. But I'd like to know what the China folk feel about that. And I don't know how it went on in England. After a year or so, doing this group leader thing, decided that it was becoming bad for me, because it really wasn't very taxing, and I was treated very well at each unit I went. And there's a danger of getting possibly underneath, even subconsciously, a rather swollen head about it. And it was time I went back to just being an ordinary person in an ordinary unit, and if possible somewhere abroad. And so put that up. And then so that's when I was asked to lead the second section of the out to the Hatfield Spears.